Okay, I think it's going now. Let's see. Today's date is February the 21st, 2020. My name is Jonathan Gerland, and I'm in the home today of Ted Ivey in Huntington. And we are going to do an oral history interview. And Mr. Ivey, I guess maybe a good place to start is we were looking at a map earlier about Cyrus Ivey. Just kind of start talking about how the Ivies came to this part of the world and what you know of your family history, and then we'll work our way up to where and when you were born.
Well, from the documents that we have, Cyrus Ivey came to Angelina County in 1859.
Where did he come from? Where did the family move from, do you know?
He was born and raised in Walton County, Georgia.
Okay.
Had a family of five children when he left Walton County, Georgia. He and his wife and five children, and one was an infant. And the next that we heard was they were in Pontotoc County, Mississippi. And that's where his wife Susan passed away, Cyrus's wife Susan passed away, and he with an infant and four other children. I don't know exactly the time frame, but he married an Alice White in Pontotoc County, Mississippi. My understanding is there was an Ivy plantation in Pontotoc County, Mississippi, where the people coming west, especially the Ivies, would stop over at that plantation. For what reasons, I don't know, but of course he buried his first wife there in Pontotoc County, okay. Mississippi. Then he, along with his brother Josiah, continued west, and his brother Josiah settled in Butler, a community called Butler, that's east of Fairfield, Texas, on the west side of the Trinity River. And Cyrus came on across the Trinity with his family and bought acreage in, I believe it's 40 acres or 60 acres in Anderson County, Palestine. How he heard about this land patent in Angelina County, I don't know, but he did, and he came over here in 1859 and got the land patent. We got records where he sold his acreage in Anderson County,
okay,
and moved his family to here to this 320-acre land patent with his new wife and a young baby from his first wife and four of the children. And so that's how he came here in 1859, and that would be about 13 years after this became a county.
That Cyrus Ivey land grant, about how far away is it from where we are right now?
It's about 10 minutes, about 4.5 miles.
Okay, and that's where you were saying earlier where the Ivey Cemetery is.
That's where the Ivey Cemetery is.
And y'all worked on getting that historical marker a few years ago.
Right.
And about how many people are buried there in the Ivey Cemetery? Do you remember offhand?
I think you probably have. I've got it. I've got an accurate count.
That's okay.
I've got an accurate count of it. But there's at least, there's probably 20, approximately 20 of the older settlers buried there in the, and starting in the 1800s, the first grave was 1873.
Okay.
And then there's been graves added since then. And, of course, it's really a community cemetery.
Right.
It's not just a family cemetery now. It's family. If you have family buried in there, you can get a plot to be buried in there.
And that was on the Cyrus Ivey land grant.
That's on and he had a grandson buried in there in 1873 as far as our records show.
Okay.
That was the first one.
So Cyrus's grandson.
And then he and his wife Alice are buried in there, and his son.
Do you know where the old home place was?
Yeah, Miss Lucy Connor lives on their old home place. Yeah, his first home place was just as you go into the, as far as I know, because my dad was born there, my grandpa was born there and my dad was born there, and I had one of my older brothers was born there on that old place.
And what were their names?
My grandfather's name was William Joshua.
Okay.
Ivy. And my dad was Bolivar Cleveland. And my brother was Daniel Palmer, and that's the reason the road's named Palmer Ivy Road now.
Oh, yeah.
And so he was.
That's your older brother, huh?
That's one of my older brothers, yeah. My next to oldest brother. My oldest brother was born here in the edge of Huntington, out here.
Okay.
On Porterville Road.
So what did your father do?
He taught school from 1911, taught here in Huntington, he taught at Odell, and he taught at Orr. He taught school for 10 years.
How did he get to be a school teacher? Self-taught.
And he went through whatever education he could get, there was three of the boys, he had two brothers, and all three of them taught school at one time, you know, and Debbie D. Ivy, Dan Ivy, everybody called him Old Uncle Dan, was the oldest. He was born in 1880. And I did his autobiography when I was in 1945. He was sick for about 3 months. And so I did his autobiography. I roughed it with a Big Chief tablet every evening. I took, he was in the bed sick, and I was taking care of his livestock up here where my pasture is and that. And probably one reason I was able to buy the pasture off my aunt, because I did do a lot of work for him. But anyway, he...
So you, like, interviewed him and got his stories?
Each evening after I finished my chores, and he'd give me about an hour. He had asthma, and he had, I don't know, he had flu, pneumonia, but stayed in bed about 3 months to get over it. And,
now, is that just your idea to do that? Was that something you just
it wanted to do? It was a project for English.
For school, it was.
We should interview a person. Well, and when I completed by writing it on blue horse notebook paper. And when I got through, my mother had to tie it together with yarn. I had so many pages. And Miss Josie Cloud was an English teacher here in Huntington. They ran the newspaper also, her and her husband.
That was the Herald?
No, it was. I believe it's called the Huntington News.
Okay.
I think that's what it was.
Okay.
And this was in the 40s, during World War II. My whole high school career was through World War II. I went in as a freshman. In 1941, September 1941, the war started in December 7, 1941, and right on through my school career. But anyway, Miss Josie gave me an A on it, and she asked me if she could use it at the newspaper, because he was born in 1880. He was here when Huntington came. He was already a merchant with his father-in-law when the Huntington was started. So I had a lot of valuable stuff that I didn't realize I had, you know.
I let her borrow
the paper, and it didn't have that much meaning until now. It has a lot of meaning now, but they used it, and she taught school in Huntington. I went in the Navy, you know, and after I got out of the Navy, 4 years in the Navy, well, I went to work at Shell Oil Company in Deer Park in Houston at the refinery. Worked 36 years there. And they moved away to Midland. They closed the news, and they moved to Midland. She taught in Midland, and he worked.
That's the Clouds?
That's the Clouds, yeah.
Okay.
And occasionally, very seldom did I ever see her. And I would ask her if she knew, I think it's at the school. Well, I didn't pursue it. To make it as short as I can, if she retired and came back here, Mr. Cloud died. They lived in Denton, and she and her daughter came back here. And she had searched frantically for that. And she said, I think when I moved away, I left a box of stuff in Huntington. And they wrote me and told me they had it intact. And she wrote them back, unbeknownst to me, wrote them back and said, what can be used in the library, put it in the library. And the rest of it, you can do what you want to. So I feel like that's where my autobiography went away. But, you know, I can remember bit pieces.
What he said.
But I had actual dates, you know, and times of things that happened. And a lot of it was about my ancestors passing away. He knew when Cyrus, he was born 80, Cyrus died about 90, I think, so he was 10. And then his dad died, Josh, my grandfather died in 94. And 95, and my dad was only 4 years old, so he didn't remember Grandpa. Of course, he died before he was born, but he just barely could remember little things about his dad.
So for three brothers to all be school teachers, what was going on with that?
I don't know. They were intelligent men. They had good minds on them, and I don't know where it came from. The Collinses or from the Ives. Their mother was a Collins. Her dad was the first sheriff of Angelina County, George Thomas Wharton Collins. So he's my great-grandfather.
Okay.
And he's buried in the Carroll Cemetery down here on Ralph Nearing Road. But they self-educated. They got all educated, but they read and they studied, and all three of them almost wrote identically. Boy, they had pretty handwritings. I mean, that tells me something, but he studied old books, you know, high school self-taught and stuff like that, and of course, it's time, you had to have, he had a certificate, a teacher's certificate,
which school would they have gone to? The public school.
Well, look here.
If he was born in 80,
no, my dad was born in 91.
Well, no, I was talking about.
I can't tell you much about Uncle Dan's teaching and Uncle George's, but I know more about my dad. Huntington High School, about 1911, bottom of Sea Alley, Phil.
Yeah. He's showing a photograph of Huntington School. Yeah. Okay.
There
okay.
He is, right there.
No, I was meaning before Huntington came around. I'm just curious.
Uncle Dan, he was always.
Was it Odell or?
It would have been in the Odell School or in the Oak Flat or Orr School.
Okay.
Orr probably because it was, Orr was the, really the key city.
Okay.
After you left,
again, we're talking before Huntington.
After you left Homer, well, Orr was, of course, you know yourself, the first county seat was at Marin. And Jonesville down here started growing, so the commissioners decided they'd move it to Jonesville. Well, Homer started outgrowing Jonesville, so they voted to move it to Homer. The railroad was supposed to come through Homer, but it didn't come through Homer. It went through Lufkin, so it ended up going to Lufkin.
So the early history of the county was more tied to this end, or not really end, but section of the county. And it gradually moved west, huh?
I'm sure that Marin was probably the largest. You know, they did shipping up and down to Angelina.
Mm-hmm.
It was clear for it.
Not necessarily the Natchez, yeah. Angelina was deeper.
Angelina, that's right. And they came up, but as log jams, they had a lot of problems with log jams at first, one thing another. But Marin was made that first county seat. It was probably the largest thing on the river, but they chose Jonesville because it's more centrally located in the county, and the commissioners did. But
where were you born and what year?
I was born June the 16th, 1928, right over here where this old White House is, right here.
I think your wife was telling me about that a little bit earlier. Yeah,
but I was born in an old home that had a dog run through it, and it burned when I was... In 1932, when I was 4 years old, it burned, and I had a brother that was three, had a little brother that was 1 year old.
So you grew up literally in the Depression?
Yes, sir. Right through all of it. Ever.
Because you probably didn't even know any difference, because that's all you knew, huh?
No, because it didn't bother anybody, because not many, each dad was working as hard as he could to
to bring home, to make a living for his family.
Was your dad mostly farming, or what was he?
He
taught school, but...
He taught school for the 10 years, me and my mother. He and my mother married in 1920, and his wife had passed away, and he had two little boys. And he was living with he's living at the old place, and he had moved into Huntington in 1920 from the old place with his two boys and his mother-in-law and a small brother-in-law.
Now, who was his mother-in-law?
An O'Quinn. Granny O'Quinn. He married, her husband was the second pastor of Huntington First Baptist Church, A.B. O'Quinn.
Okay.
And my dad married his daughter, and she passed away. She passed away in 1918.
Okay.
And that left him with a one-year-old child and a three-year-old child. Flu epidemic was in, you know, along in that time. So he and my mother married in 1920. She had moved.
And who was your mother?
Mary Ethel Prestridge.
Prestridge.
And Mary Ethel came in. Her father came here in the late 1890s with his dad and his family. But they came with the Frost.
The Frost of the
Frost Johnson. Frost Johnson from Texarkana and Shreveport. They had sawmills. So they came here with, I don't know if the Johnson came along with him, but it was T.L.L. Temple and George Kelly, and I think one of the Kurth.
And that was for Lufkin Land and Lumber
Lufkin
Company?
Lufkin Land. They started Lufkin Land out there, and I've got...
Where did Prestridges come from?
They lived in Texarkana also?
Okay.
Yeah, that's where they were from.
Because I know a little station on the railroad over here was named for them.
That's right.
Yeah.
Named for my grandfather, Joseph Warner. He was a wood superintendent.
Joseph Warner Prestridge.
Went all the way across the river to Broadus and White City.
Through Monterey, up to Broadus, and down to White City. Yeah, okay. Yeah, I always wondered where the Prestridges came from.
Well, that's where they came from, and they were from Texarkana and Arkansas. My great-great-grandfather, George Hooper, was the father of Joseph Warner. And
now, are those surnames or middle names? Hooper and Warner.
George Hooper Prestridge.
Okay, yes,
the father of Joseph Warner Prestridge and George Simeon Prestridge. And they were the nephews. They were the nephews of Enoch Wesley Frost.
E.W. Frost.
And he brought his son Edward Ambrose Frost with him. So he brought two nephews, his son, and his family. But the reason that came about, because George Hooper Prestridge's sister, Mary Ann Rebecca Frost, was a sister to Enoch Wesley Frost. So the Prestridges were tied. And to chase another rabbit, one of those Prestridge girls married Warner Brown, and they went from Arkansas toward Kentucky, and
he
was a founder of Brown Mule Chewing Tobacco. That's where it got it. Is that enough?
Yeah. Well, that's interesting. I'm glad we chased those rabbits. So that's your mom So you were born in 28. When did they marry? When did your father marry?
Married in 1920, and he had the two little boys. And in 1921, my sister was born. And in 1923, my brother George Prestridge was born. George Prestridge, named after Uncle George and the Prestridges. And then in 25, my brother Edwin Warner was born. And then in 28, I was born. I've named that. I don't know where they got the Teddy. I don't know. And
was it just Teddy or Theodore?
It's Teddy. It wasn't no Theodore to it. Just Teddy. And then
you have a middle name?
Bolivar.
Bolivar. Oh, that's right. You said that.
Okay, and so that came from my dad. He's Bolivar. And that came from my grandmother's brother, Bolivar Collins, who you're sitting on land that's a Collins addition to the township of Huntington. Huntington ended right out here on the street that you drove up, your first layout. This is a Collins addition to the township of Huntington. And the old home is standing right over here that he built in right around 1900. And so that's, we're sort of in the, this old home, the Uncle Bolivar Collins home and the Dr. Stewart home. And there may be one other home that was built in the, right around 1900.
Okay. Yeah,
they're the oldest homes.
Talk about growing up. What are some of your earliest memories?
Oh, well, it was during the Depression. And, you know, if there was a money crop around Huntington, if you weren't in the, if you weren't a merchant or a doctor or, you know, say a professional, my dad went to work in the bank in 21. His Uncle George, his brother George bought the newspaper out and he quit the bank and my dad became cashier of the bank. So he was in the bank from 21, under the state bank from 21 till 1935. So my dad had, he had a job all, up until 1935 during the Depression, you know. And so that helped him, certainly made us, you weren't wealthy working in the bank, but you could buy.
You had to stay.
You could meet your needs, you know. And
but so y'all lived right here, kind
right
of.
Here, right
and,
here.
And
when this home burned.
Technically, that was in town back then, right?
Yes, you could say I was a city dude. I was born two blocks off of Maine.
But did y'all farm here? Did you raise your own food or?
Well, just let me give you one example.
Okay.
Right here on the corner of this vacant lot was a home. All the way, it borders Pecan over here and Walnut over here, down to 3rd Street. There was one little old car shed for the people that lived across Pecan Street. A buggy, a wagon shed, whatever you want to call it. Still, we still had wagon sheds and buggy sheds, and as I can remember. And that would, somebody would plant that in cotton. One old home was right over here. That other 2 or 3 acres behind it could be in cotton. Two houses were right here on Walnut. And the gin was down where Dean's is, the cotton gin. And we had a gin over where the city park is. And you had a gin over, cotton gin over where Brookshire Brothers is. So we had 3 gins in Huntington. I've gone to sleep at night during ginning season, you know, say middle September, late August, middle September. Gone to sleep on a Saturday night, especially when so many came into town with a bale of cotton, with a team pulling a bale of cotton, pulling a wagon of cotton. And you know, there's ginning at night, so they had to go home at night. And those wagons and mules, they didn't have no flashlights and stuff like that, maybe a lantern. But I've gone to sleep and heard all 3 of those cotton gins running. But of course, we went to bed at dark.
You know. Right.
Yeah, lights out, the lamp went out.
No electricity then, huh?
Well, there was electricity, all right, in the house. When they built the new home back, I was in the 3rd grade. And for a while, we didn't have electricity. We moved in without electricity. And had wood stoves, cook stoves, wood heaters, or fireplace. We had a fireplace, and they don't know if that might have caused the house. But he had a big chimney built in the house that sufficed the cook stove, yeah. The kitchen cook stove, and it also.
But did y'all raise peas and potatoes and things like that?
Anything we could. My dad was a super gardener, and boy, anything that you could plant anything on, it was planted, you know,
okay.
Around this place. Right? We had an acre here, and this place was an acre. And
Did you have any milk cows?
Yeah, we had milk cows. We had chickens. We raised pigs right here, hogs right here in town.
Yeah.
Had litter. Butcher.
Was there a hog law for the town at the time, or did you just let your hogs run free?
No, hogs ran loose. Then the city probably started a hog law. They had to be penned. You could have them. But then the county's hog law didn't go into effect sometime in the 40s.
Right. But it didn't affect where y'all lived. I mean, did your hogs run free or did you keep them pinned?
No, we had to keep them pinned.
You had to keep them pinned. Okay.
Now, cows, Cows could still run free. Cows and horses could still run free.
Yeah, but the hogs had to be.
Pass or pass the hog. Yeah. You know. But
then, I've seen some of the older photos around your house a while ago, and I guess you had picket fences around your place?
Yeah, my dad, we had a picket fence around over here, and then we had a chicken pen, and we had a cow pen, and we had a hog pen. Of course, we didn't have this every street in.
And you had milk cow too, huh?
Yeah, had milk cows, and my Uncle Dan had 30-something acres right up here that he farmed all the time. And then right across the railroad track, he had 105 acres. He had no boys. So guess whose boys worked for Uncle Dan?
So you picked cotton?
He was 10 years older than my dad. Uh-huh. And so, yes, we picked cotton. We pulled corn. We picked peas. We did everything.
Do you remember how much cotton you could pick?
Not very much. No. I don't know exactly when I broke 100. You know, but I had one older brother. I think about the same time, my brother Ed, he was a good cotton picker. Ed picked 201 or something, and I picked 105 that day. So, you know, but he was older, you know.
He was twice as good.
Yeah, he was really twice. But I probably, as time went on, I could pick more than that, but I didn't want to pick
cotton. How young would you be when you started picking cotton? How old did you need to be to start picking cotton?
When I was When our home burned, we moved across the railroad tracks to what we call the Caton place. And I don't know exactly how many acres Miss Caton had, but she was in Beaumont living with her sister. And we rented her place. And my two older brothers, W.J. and Palmer, they were in high school. And they had an ag project, and it was cotton. So my dad knew how to instruct them and everything. He was running the bank, you know, working at the bank. And so that was my first cotton picking when I was probably about 5 years old.
5 years old.
Yeah, and you know, that was just, you know, about how a five-year-old would pick cotton. You can imagine.
Try to get out of it.
But I was trained. I was trained, you know, in by some of the best, you know, just because, I mean, some people could straddle a row of cotton and pick both sides of it, you know, just getting after if the cotton was the right height. An adult. You know, but I was like a young kid, you know, I'd pick and move it to this hand and do this. And, well, that was kind of the habit I got into. But as I grew older, I was taught by the adults, you know, just you pick that cotton, move that hand, go that sack like that. You know, just it was a steady movement, you know.
Talk about segregation a little bit. What do you remember of the races?
Uncle Dan always had a family of black people living on his place.
So and as tenants, huh? Tenant farmers. Okay.
Yeah, and it was it wasn't necessarily sharecroppers. He was going to share. He and my aunt were going to share. They were going to see that the family was taken care of, and whether it be getting to the doctor or whatever.
Do you remember what their surname was?
Mott.
Mott? The black family?
The black family.
Okay.
I don't know what Adoy's wife's name was. Adoy Mott. And if somebody's family ended up, there's still some in Lufkin. I don't know how great grandchildren or what it is, but they were a good family. But all I ever heard his wife call was Go Baby.
Go Baby.
Go Baby.
So did y'all work along beside them picking cotton?
Right alongside them. Yeah. And then played with them, you know.
Uh-huh.
I was younger than all of the boys. I was younger than all the Mott boys. But he had a family of Trotties. Green Trotty was his name, and he had some boys that were about...
How would you spell that last name?
I think it was T-R-O-T-T-I.
Oh, Trotties, okay.
I don't think it was Y.
Okay.
And they were a real good family, and me and my younger brother, we played with a couple of those boys a lot. You know, we just... games and throwing a ball or something. We didn't have much...
Y'all play baseball?
We didn't have much... Yeah, we played softball, yeah.
But would you play...
Play around here and where we could find...
Did the whites and blacks play...
No, really we didn't because the schools were segregated, right. And they had an elementary school, a couple of different places in Huntington, one over here on the highway and one out on Gibsonville Road. They went to high school at Dunbar and Lufkin.
Oh, okay.
That went to high school.
Right.
Dunbar and Lufkin.
Okay.
Didn't have a, you know, when the integration or segregation went through, well, they all started just going to school here in Huntington. We didn't have about the only time you'd see Hispanics was if we made a trip into Lufkin with a family or something, and you'd see Hispanics, and majority of those Hispanics, they said, was from Nacogdoches County.
What about the railroad? Do you remember seeing Hispanics or railroad laborers? Track maintenance, anything?
Not
like
many.
That?
Of course, the cotton belt was still. They could run it ran down. They had a tomato shed over here. It stopped in Huntington. They first started taking it up from brought us across the river back to Huntington. And so this spur stayed active for a good long while. If they didn't use nothing but a motor car on it. And it was there was about three residential cars that stayed for a long time over here after the cotton belt shut down. And I don't know who was in charge of that, but I know that they used it until, I can remember the cotton belt being taken up, but I don't know what year
right,
it was.
Right. And what about the Texas New Orleans, the road to
Nacogdoches? It's been taken up since.
Yeah, I meant the workers. You remember seeing any?
Oh yeah, that's section crews. Mr. Rhodes, Powell Rhodes was a section foreman. Mr. Case was a section foreman. He used to go in the depot down here and talk to Mr. Buckner, and he'd show us how the telegraph worked, you know, and stuff like that. Yeah, I enjoyed that. So you
remember the steam engines, I guess, the steam locomotives?
Yeah, quite well. Remember all the sidecars. The cars would come in and put them on the sidetrack with loads of feed and whatever, and then they'd put the sidecars down to pick up the... Had a big tie yard there and,
cross ties, yeah.
And I don't think they, of course the paper mill was so close after it started in 41, you know, 40, whenever it mm-hmm. was. I don't think they ever loaded it, but they did. Men still made cross ties and brought them in and stacked them there.
And then the sawmill,
the sawmill started cutting them up. They were hand-hewed ties, yeah.
Do you remember seeing those men carrying those ties on
yes,
the shoulders
yeah,
and stuff?
Yeah, I've carried those ties.
You've done it too,
yeah, huh? In high school. Yeah, and it was a load. It wasn't something I enjoyed. I was just helping my brother. He had a truck and we was hauling for other people, you know. Go to the woods and pick up their ties and bring them up here and put them in the tie.
Okay. Did you ever hew yourself or did you just...
My dad did.
My dad
taught us how to hew a tie, but... No, I don't think any of his sons ever cared anything about hewing a tie.
If you didn't have to, huh?
No, we didn't.
But yeah, I mean, that was, you talk about labor.
Everything back then was muscle labor. It can really hurt your shoulder to end up a tie and let it drop back down on your shoulder and start heading for a truck with it. And me, I staggered a whole lot because it's heavy on the legs.
Oh, yes, sir. Yes, sir. But
my Uncle Dan, jump back just a moment. He married Winnie Beard. And their old home is still
Beard
standing.
Or Baird?
Baird, however you want to say it. From the Ball Hill community.
Right, yeah. It's his
Lewis Beard. Lewis Beard was his father-in-law. And Mr. Baird had a grocery store and a saloon. Uncle Dan became his son-in-law, married Aunt Winnie Baird, and he started working in the saloon and the store. Well, Prohibition come along, they shut the saloons down, and Uncle Dan bought Mr. Baird out in the store. But Mr. Baird and a Russell had tried to start a town pretty close to where the Prestige is down there, where the tracks grow. They built a tavern down there. This is Sheridan something, or maybe from my dad or whatever. And, but it didn't take hold. And, so when they brought the railroad through, Huntington was built here. They sold, Mr. Towns and Mr. Blunt had the land around here, and they cut it up into lots.
E.A. Blunt from Nacogdoches, right. And W.J. Townsend from Lufkin, huh?
Right, that's right. And, so the Townsends married in with the Prestiges and everything, so my mother became a relative of the Townsends also. And, but, he operated that store till 1928, the one that I wrote his autobiography.
Mm-hmm.
And he took an old, when he went out of business, had an old sign that said, Beard and Ivy, where a dollar does its duty.
Where a dollar does its duty,
and it's a metal sign about so big. Well, they tacked it up on the barn. And, he tacked up on the barn in the 1930s. My dad built his barns for him. He had two big barns up there. And, he tacked that up on, when we'd pull a wagon up, and that was that sign always, Beard and Ivy work. Well, my aunt sold me 24 acres of the 30 acres, 31 acres up here where their home was on this side of the track. And one day I said, hey, Winnie, I said, what are you going to do with this sign out there Uncle Dan's had by the wagon shed off of? I don't know, son. I said, you want it? I said, well, I'd love to have it. Well, my daughter has it in her family room in Deer Park now, on a rough board, you know.
Yeah.
Put it on. And so we still have that old sign.
So the store closed, I guess, the year you were born, huh? So,
uh-huh.
So you don't really remember
and
the
it
store.
And it stayed a long time, and we used to go through it. It was vacant. He had stuff he didn't take out of there, and it was old vinegar barrels and stuff like that. And we'd go back, some of it still had vinegar in them, you know, and of course they had a wooden pump, and they didn't mean nothing to us. They were just junk, you know. We didn't want no vinegar. But I said, what a treasure, you know. You think back on it. But you never, you just, kids this day and time pass stuff up. Well, I did too, because it had no meaning. And it was just something to hold vinegar or whatever else they might have sold.
A curiosity to you, though.
Yeah. We'd go by on the way to school, you know. Let's go through Uncle Dan's old store. Well, you would go through it. That old vinegar barrel, you know, wooden pump in that stuff. It'd be a treasure today, you know.
Talk about school. What do you remember about school that you hadn't
seen? Well, I remember first grade pretty well. I started first grade here in Huntington. And had one little friend lived up the road from us there. We were living at the Caton place right across the tracks over here. And the Caton, old Caton home is still there. And I started school and had a good friend, Sonny Jones, lived right up there. He lived on the Yancey place. His mother and daddy, Otha Jones, was a store merchant here for a good many years. But I think he was managing Brookshire's. Brookshire's was number 15 down here. They just tore that building down in the last two or three years, and where four-way water is here when you turn off a main.
Okay.
That was the big brick building. Went in his automobile dealership in the early 20s. My mother could remember when it was being built, but she didn't know exactly the year that it was built. And I captured a lot of my stuff off my mother too, you know.
Did y'all have an automobile when you were?
Sometimes we didn't. States? We didn't always have a car, but we had a car a lot of times. And of course, that was funny. My mother and dad married in 1920, and she had come from Texarkana she'd come from Houston, but from Texarkana after her folks died, lived with her grandparents in Houston she could drive. And my dad had a horse, a saddle horse, and he had a horse and buggy. And so he couldn't drive. He never could. But that,
She was uptown, huh?
She was uptown girl, but anyway, she adjusted to Huntington. Because she said, wasn't no sense trying to talk your dad out of it. He's going to live in Huntington. But anyway, I started first grade, and I started first grade, and we moved. Miss Caton came back, and my dad's brother George had a home over here close to where the old City Hall is, right there on Gibson Street by the bank. And the home is still there right now. But it's set there where the brick city, old City Hall was. Or it's a, I think it's a nursery, a daycare now. But we moved to there. And my uncle was moving to Conroe. He'd been in the bank, newspaper, but he was an accountant. He went to Conroe and set up a CPA. And that's where he died. Uncle George Ivey died in Conroe. He became a county clerk, stuff like that. But in 1935, when the bank closed, my dad was out of a job. And it's still, he got a job as cashier at the Kirbyville State Bank.
Kirbyville.
So we moved to Kirbyville.
Okay.
About the middle of my, long at the last of my first grade, we moved to Kirbyville. I went into the first grade there, and they tried to move me to the second grade. My folks said, keep him in the second, keep him in the first grade. So then the next year I went into the second grade, and my dad said, I'm going back to Huntington. Going back to Huntington. They're going.
Without a job?
Yeah, without a job, but with a... He went to Groveton and worked at the bank over there. We live here in Huntington. We moved back to Huntington in his, that's right, his brother George had another house over here. And we moved into that house. And that's where we lived and while we was building it. We still live. We came back when I was in the second grade. I moved to second grade in Kirbyville and we came back and I was in the second grade here in the same little building that I was in the first grade in. So
when your father, you said he worked in Groveton for a little while?
He went over.
But y'all didn't,
we were living here.
Moved,
he went over there.
No, okay.
He was just going, okay, he wasn't satisfied with that. Came back, went to Cleveland.
Cleveland, Texas.
Yeah. Worked in the bank at Cleveland. Wasn't satisfied with that. Somebody offered him a job here. He went in the bank. Oh, yeah, he came back and worked at Brooks's.
Okay.
Miss Ota Jones was mad. He worked at Brookshire's.
Okay.
As assistant manager at Brookshire.
So you and the family stayed here, and he
that's
was
right.
just trying out.
That's right.
Trying
well,
out different
well, he
jobs.
He had a car, you know. He could travel, but he had the room. He wouldn't come home from Cleveland. I don't think he came home Groveton every day. He may have. Of course, I was.
Yeah, you're only old. About seven then. How seven?
But anyway, and my mother said, "Well, that's your dad."
How many brothers and sisters did you have at that time that were living at home? I mean, how many people was he supporting?
We had the two older brothers, and my sister, and four other boys. So we had seven. There were seven of us.
Were the older boys able to help support the family?
The oldest one went in the Army in 30. Let's see, let me do my math real quick. 15, he was born 1915. He went in the Army in about 1935. And the next one went in about 37.
Okay, so it was during that time
Those
period
two,
then?
Yeah, in that time period. We were living in Kirbyville when the oldest one went in the Army because he graduated from high school. He graduated from high school and he came down and got my mother and dad signed the papers for him to go in the Army. And we were back in Huntington when the other one went in the Army.
Okay. And I guess did they stay through when World War II started? Were they still in the military?
The oldest one did 26 years of continuous service, I believe it was. I got their pictures in there. And the other one went in and he got out and he did a 3-year hitch, so he went in 36 and he stayed out for a while. Did a 3-year hitch and he went back in and he was in Puerto Rico when World War II started on his And so he did about 9.5 years, I think, okay. total.
But they were both.
They were both
during the war. Were they Europe or the?
Those
Pacific?
Two went to Europe, and then my sister, and then my next two brothers were both in the South Pacific in World War II. And me and my next brother were in the Korean War. That's the cert. I went in 1948 and he went in 1949.
Okay.
So, but anyway, so there were six of us boys have did service, and then I'll show you their picture. You may have looked at it.
Your wife was showing me earlier. Yes, sir.
So
yes,
that's
sir.
All of the ones in it.
So anyway, I guess kind of chronologically, did you finish school up at Huntington?
I graduated from high school in Huntington.
Okay. Did you play sports?
Yes, played basketball for the Huntington Red Devils. We didn't have an organized baseball team or softball team. We played some softball, just
but pick up games.
We didn't have a coach for that.
No organized, yeah.
And I always have to tell people, you don't realize, even to students, what a change World War II made. When the war started in 1941, almost immediately, you started seeing things. Of course, it took away the young men that went to the service, and the young women. When the WAC started, that's when the WAC Corps started. But it took away young men graduating from high school and older, and the draft started, and you went whether you wanted to go or not, you know, if you passed the physical, you didn't get a deferment or you didn't have something that valuable to the war effort, some job, or that was a deferment, you know. But it started taking away from the families. It took their children away, and they started rationing goods. You had to get the stamps to get gas. You had to get the stamps to buy sugars. Cigarettes were almost out of the question in a lot of cases, and merchants didn't get many cigarettes, so they kind of went out toward the favors. But I played varsity 1945-46. I was on the varsity, 45-46. And we were still using the same uniforms that the coach had ordered in 1939 or 40. The same warm-ups, the same. Only thing we had new was if you could look enough to buy a new jockey strap, you know, somewhere, or socks and shoes. But we used those same Red Devil uniforms, and I think they got new ones in 47. We got a jacket my senior year. You didn't get a jacket in 45 because you couldn't hardly buy them, you know. Not in the schools could. Some of the schools couldn't afford much anyway. But you got a H in a basketball for letter, you know. Mm-hmm. You got a red H. You could put it on anything you wanted to. That was just some of the things you saw, but so much was taken away from you. You didn't have the paper, the materials and everything to do the yearbook anymore. My sister got her 38 and 39 yearbook, the Echo. My next brother behind her, he got his 40 and 41 yearbook. No more yearbooks until 1947. And a guy gave me I got those four copies. A guy gave me a copy of the 1947 yearbook, and it lists all of us that went through the, lists all of our graduating classes that went through the,
through the war,
42, 43, 44, 45, 46.
Kind of catching up, huh?
Yeah, it just lists our names in there. And would you believe it, I'm in the senior class 2 years in a row. I could tell you a lengthy story about me going back to get a credit. I could have got it at summer school in Lufkin. They had summer school. We didn't have any summer. I could have gone and got that. But my dad, he let me know when I started talking about that. Because I wanted to go into service. I had four brothers in the service and the war was still going on. I wanted to go into service. I thought I wanted to go into service. My dad didn't want me to go into service.
So he said, go back to school. Huh?
He said, no, no, said you, I was still 16 years old when I would have graduated.
It would have been 17 in June. He said, I have you a job at the paper mill. Our neighbor was a foreman in the woodyard, and he said that he wanted to work me during the summer in the woodyard. He said, you're going to work at the paper mill between 46, and you're going back to school next year, and you're going to get that credit. Well, the thing about going back to school, you have to take 3 subjects, you know, if you enrolled in school. Well, he said, you still can play basketball. Said, you play another, and you got some more friends of yours that's having to go back, too. There was 2 or 3 of us. He said, oh, yeah, by the way, he said, I'm not going to sign for you to go in the Navy. And he said, if anybody else does, I'll have him sent to prison.
He wasn't going to have his...
But he wanted his kids to get an education.
Right.
And we did. And I spoke last year at the high school graduation. They asked me to speak. And I tried to tell them how many times in my life that I'd been so glad that I got that in. Because I can't tell you the number of times I was asked on an application or anything else, did you have a high school education? That's one of the requirements when I went to work at Shell, when you have a high school education. And even to, that was one of the requirements when I went in the Navy to get to take a test to see if you go to a naval training school. Mm-hmm. And so it just started out right away.
I say, it's one of those boxes you can check.
It is. And I said, and you do not have to, college degree, I've got 3 of my brothers had college degrees, and I'm all proud of them, but I had to be a steward. I had to be a steward of probably as much as they had to be a steward of. So you go through life having to be a steward of whatever you have.
Right, right.
You know that yourself.
Right.
If you bring in $100 a month, don't spend $150. You're gonna be in trouble.
Talk about some basketball rivalries. And I guess I'm thinking of Zavala, but...
Well, Zavala schools? Was always... That was always... We usually had a scuffle with Zavala. we had a... Redland had a bad... You know, Redland had a high school, and they were a competitive group. They always had a... They get it from that whole area back in there, the Redland school did. And Central, we played in the auditorium at Central back then, and it had a concrete floor. And it wasn't a very big gym. And that was the old Central school out there. And we played at Dieball. One of our rivals was Big Sandy, the Indian Reservation. And they had a gym that didn't have lights, so we had to play daytime games. But they came to Huntington. We played Jasper. We played Newton, Silsby, Hemp Hill. That was it. But Kirbyville was always...
You played West Sabine?
Huh?
West Sabine?
No, that school, that independent school district wasn't... I don't believe there was a West Sabine in the 40s.
Okay.
I think that was... Wasn't that a conglomerate of schools, really? Or community? West Sabine Independent School District? Yeah, because I think... A coach that we had here left and went to West Sabine.
Okay.
I don't remember playing Buena. Of course, Cotton Robinson was a best known coach in East Texas. You know, he coached Buena for years and years, Cotton Robinson. And he always put out good teams, defensive teams especially. But we played tournaments back then like they do now. And we'd go to Jasper, we'd go to Newton. We had them here in Huntington. And Kirbyville, they had tournaments at Kirbyville.
When were the games played?
Where were they played?
When? What day of the week did y'all have?
Probably like it, sort of like it is now, Tuesday and Friday.
Okay.
Maybe that's what it was. Tournaments were through a weekend. Playoffs were
usually. Y'all would play on Saturdays? Tournaments, yeah. Okay.
Nothing on Sunday. Nothing was scheduled on Sunday. Even Little League wasn't scheduled for a year on Sunday. It wasn't scheduled on Wednesdays either. Wednesday night, church service.
Yeah.
Little League won for years. But we play, everybody plays anytime now.
So any particular memories about any particular games or
You mentioned scuffle when we talked about Zavala.
Well, Zavala had a guy with a short fuse, and we had a guy that had a short fuse, and it was almost a given as to when they was going to get under the bucket and really tie up before it came out, and maybe a technical foul called or two or something like that, but that was a rivalry, you know. But we knew nearly everybody there, and they knew us, but we didn't know like kids get to know now. There was no phones, there was no very few vehicles, and so, you know, you might not see a guy from Zavala until school year started and you played them, you know. You might not see them the rest of go to Zavala for a home game, come up here, they'd come up for a home game for us, and it was good. But going back, such a shortage during that time frame that I look back and I think we were, I don't know, Lufkin of course had more, there was more, a stronger tax base than there was here.
Is it right to say that what you're getting at is that the war years were a little more depressed for y'all than leading up to the war years? Would you say that? Or
yeah, because you were coming up and it was new. There were uniforms and there were jackets every right. year for kids.
But you're talking about the young men were just absent. They were gone when the war came.
They left, and then you had the high school kids around here, and all of a sudden, in your school, the things that you look forward to, the little rewards, from the basketball jackets to the whatever the girls' activities was. I think they had volleyball, but they didn't have any girls' basketball. But a lot of that was taken. And I don't bemoan that. It was a necessity because we were oriented from the get-go to win the war. Mm-hmm. You know, one of our, had a little shoe shop here in Huntington. I'll never forget that. Leslie Denman ran the little shoe shop, and he was drafted, and he hung a sign on his door, closed, gone to kill Hitler. And we saw that every day when we went back. And our superintendent was, Mr. Cannonberg was a strong patriot. He really was, from the Pledge of Allegiance to even drilling the juniors and seniors that he knew that if this war was extended, because he had been in World War One, he had been in the Army, and he knew what they were facing. So, and he could drill you just like a drill sergeant, and we practiced it. It was volunteer, but we get there before school, you know. And you practice that.
Do you remember the German POWs that were here?
Yes, you see the trucks come through every morning, saw the trains go through here with them, and saw the trains go through with the troops, our troops and everything, and then a load of POWs would go through wherever they was carrying them to. Of course, the Texas Forest Festival ground where is that the intermediate school, the middle school?
Yeah, I think it's the middle school now.
That was just a big rodeo arena and a baseball field and everything else out there. That's where we helped. The Forest Festival was something back then. Days it was the rides and the circus.
Yeah, talk about that a little bit.
Well, it was the biggest. It was Barnum Bailey to us.
Mm-hmm.
They had the animals, that whatever show came in, and they had the rodeo for 3 or 4 days. You know, it went on 3 or 4 days, and the Ferris wheel was turning for seemed like 2 weeks. You know, and every crazy car, bumper cars, and sad stuff. That was,
and they had livestock shows with it too.
Well, the 4-H part of it kind of came along later. They would have an animal show, you know. And I don't know that was for ag. I think it was for ag boys. I know because we'd have an ag show here in Huntington.
Honey, I'm sorry to bother you. Is that a MasterCard?
What, babe?
Our shell cards.
Yeah.
I thought it was a MasterCard.
It is.
They're telling me it's not. But it is, isn't it?
I can stop it if you need me to.
Okay, just stop.
See, I think we were talking about the Forest Festival, which was more or less like a county fair, wasn't it? Or
it was. It really was. It. You know, people talk about going to the county fair, and that was really the county fair to all of us in that day and time. It was. And
So the whole family would go, or would you and your friends go, or old somebody with a car?
We went as a family.
As a family, okay. Your dad, your mom, and everybody?
My dad was a good, fair-minded dad. But he believed in discipline. He believed in treating everybody like you'd like to be treated. He didn't like nicknames, because he said nicknames usually portrayed a fault about somebody. You know, from the eyes. They called one guy around here Hall Guy.
Hall Guy.
They called, and he did look different. They called
one.
Let
you go in the dirtiest bathroom in the house.
No, that's good. That's good.
They called. That's my. Come outside from outside.
That's all you're coded.
Yeah, and but there's two more bathrooms back there. So be in anyway. He didn't like the nickname part, because he said it. They nicknamed somebody from the way they looked.
Yeah.
Or the way, the shorty business. You can just say, call them by their name.
Curly, that didn't have any hair.
we sitting there, baldy or something like that. We always went as a unit, as family entertainment, you know. And we were given whatever they could afford to give us, you know, money-wise. Whether it be 15 cents, or whether it be you spend that on rides, if you spend that on something to eat, if you get a quarter, you know, if you get 30 cents or whatever, they let us go and have a good time on whatever we could have on that.
So you mentioned the Ferris wheel a couple of times. Was that a pretty big deal?
Rode the Ferris wheel. Loved to ride the Ferris wheel, yeah. Rode the bumper cars. Me and my younger brother, that's usually where we'd head.
How were the bumper cars powered?
Electric, you know.
Were electric. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, okay.
You steer those days, by the time you thought you was going, somebody bopped you from. They had a rubber bumper on the side, you know. Mm-hmm. And I don't know what the speed was, maybe 5 or 6 miles. Some of them could hit you pretty good. But
you kind of watch and see which ones were the fastest when it got your time, huh?
And you found out real quick that the carnival people, they always know where the bean is, you know. They'll take your nickel and try to get you to guess where the bean is. And the bean, they always had the penny pitching things where you pitch a penny to hit a cup, and a penny to hit that cup. And so,
what were some of the prizes you would have won? You remember?
Mostly dolls. Or trinkets or something like that.
Yeah.
And back then everything was made in Japan. Up until the war, you know. You know. But every popper you got, anything else, it didn't have China on it. It had Japan, made in Japan. The trinket stuff. The little stuff they were just gifted at making trinkets that attracted us. And, of course, I know a lot of the German made stuff was recognized as a higher level, but the Japanese were taking all of our scrap metal back in the 30s. If they wanted to turn them into ammunition, they just turned them into trinkets to send back over here to sell to us.
I remember going through some old shipping records, bills of lading and records similar to that for the railroad here, the Shreveport, Houston, and Gulf. And it was, after the mill burned down. And so I forget the dates and everything, but there were the papers of oxygen acetylene tanks, and there were several shipments of oxygen acetylene tanks to the mill, to Manning, and then within a week or two, it was just scrap metal, and it was bound for the port of Beaumont.
Uh-huh.
And I always thought that's what that was they brought in all those cutting torches and equipment, cut that mill up, and then shipped it to Port of Beaumont. See, that was in, what, 36, 37, 38, yeah. Somewhere in there.
Uh-huh.
And that's probably where it went, was over to Japan.
You bringing that up. My dad maintained friendship with his first wife's brothers, O'Quinn's.
Okay.
He was a pastor. Well, Jephthah was the oldest boy, I guess, and then my dad married Abigail O'Quinn, and then had a younger boy named A.B., named after his dad, A.B. O'Quinn. Well, they moved to Beaumont, and they took their mother. Well, Jephthah married a lady from New York, and they came back to Beaumont. He went to work for the police force, and A.B. went to work for the Beaumont Fire Department, and that's where they all retired from. But Jephthah came from New York and came and got his mother and his brother and carried them to Beaumont. So, but my dad would visit them because of his relationship with his mother-in-law, and my wife's parents were both deceased, and my mother's parents were both deceased. So anyway, he told us about going to the docks one day with Jeff. Jeff said, I'm going to go show you this Japanese ship that's loading. So they drove down to the docks there in Beaumont. This was in the 30s. And he said, while they were sitting there watching, said they were loading it with cranes and everything. The Japanese sailors were all up on the merchant ship, was all up there loading that iron. And he said, the scary part about it is one day Jephthah told my dad, said, the scary part about it is one day they may be shooting that back at us. And they did. They did. That's what they said. But they made the trinkets and sold them to us up until that time. But anyway, that's the
first. I remember there used to be the saying, made in occupied Japan. You know, so that was been after right. The war. Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah. So you're made in Japan and then made in occupied Japan.
That's right.
Yeah.
You're right. But going back to the Forest Festival, even after they turned it into a prisoner of war camp during World War II. That's where they had, kept all the German prisoners. And they worked, they cut pulpwood all through East Texas. They had trucks went through every day going to the woods.
Now there was a wreck or something. Do you remember that? This is going to be on the recording here, so I'm kind of admitting some of my ignorance or, you know, that I've forgotten some of the details of that. But do you remember something about one of the labor trucks that was carrying the POWs had a traffic accident on the highway, and somebody either got hurt or killed, and then there was a lot of, you know, it was kind of bad publicity, if nothing else, that, you know, that a local person died as a result of the prisoners. Do you remember anything about that, or?
I can't remember that.
Okay.
That incident, even though it seems like you're reminding me of something that I read, you know.
Yeah.
But I do remember the instance where they were cutting pulpwood down the old Cottonville tram.
Okay.
That went across the river. Well, in the Ozias community, they had a good size water reservoir there, right alongside the tram, and that's where the locomotives come in and brought it. They watered up there, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And it was called Jones's Pump.
Jones's Pump.
And it's still there. It's still a body of water there. If you go down Sam Hawkins Road or whichever one it is, and you'd have to know where it's at to get back into it, or the people could tell you where it's at. But anyway, they were cutting pulpwood in that area, and at noon or sometime in the afternoon, they let them go in swimming. And the old railroad levee is still there. And here's the body of water. The railroad levee was really a dam to it, you know, mm-hmm. to the reservoir, and just went back up in the woods and stopped. Been in swimming there. Used to go have family get-togethers there when I was young. But there was German, and they allowed them to have swim call.
He went into service. They allowed them to either take a bath or go in swimming, whatever it was. Well, one of them, it was brothers in that group, and one dove in, and he hit a piling, and it killed him.
Mm.
And I remember that.
I
remember that.
So one of the German prisoners died.
One of the German prisoners, and that was in the papers.
Was that spring fed? Do you know? I mean, why was there?
I think probably just from the slope of the land, it would be. It had a good clay bottom to it. And everything. It wasn't going to evaporate. It was always water there. Every time, because my grandmother was Hawkins, and she was raised in Osage community, so we had a lot of relatives then. But that was one of the incidents I remember with the prisoners. And you may correct me on this, but I believe they had it in the Lufkin Daily there in the 40s. They did go on strike for one more beer. On strike for the one more beer. That was in the papers for several days.
In fact, the same, when we did our World War II exhibit several years ago, we got the, when we were looking at D-Day, the Normandy invasion, you know, June 6th, and there were, I think, three issues that day, or, you know, the day after. Of course, you know, different side of the world, so I forget the date of the paper, but it was to cover the Normandy invasion. And on the same, right there, with coverage of the invasion, same page was the story of the POW striking. So
I remember that.
So you read about the invasion, and then they're striking here locally,
right.
And it was for more pay, yeah. And then I think it was settled the day after or something.
Yeah. But wherever they were working, you know, we'd be in school or whatever you're doing, and truckloads of them would go by from here going to the woods.
It really was trucks, not buses?
It was trucks. It was old Army GI trucks, you know, carrying.
Okay, so open, and so they'd just be sitting there.
Had a tarp halfway over it or had a frame over it, and, you know, had the cattle frames on the side, you know, and that's... But they just waved at us, and, you know, and we waved at them, you know.
What did they wear? Do you remember? Did they have uniforms or just...
Yeah, they had something to identify them.
Somebody
as a POW. Yeah, they had something. I can't remember what color it was, but they... I want to think it was gabardine, you know, blue. I want to think it was something on this order, but...
Denim, blue color?
Yeah, okay. It would be. I believe it was. They had the jumpers and stuff like that and everything. And,
did the guards have dogs or anything? Do you remember if the guards had dogs?
Oh, I think as time went by, I don't think they had much of nothing. And if one got lost, every now and then one would get lost, and he'd come up ahead. I don't think they ever had any problem with any runaways. I don't remember any runaways. What did they want to escape for? They had a good deal, you know. They weren't any danger of getting killed.
Well, I remember talking to some people, and they used to have dances at those POW. You know, Lufkin had two camps.
Yeah.
Where the Forest Service officers used to be was another one, and I've talked to some ladies, and there were several instances where basically what I remember the women telling me is, you know, all the boys were gone. It's like what you were saying.
Yeah.
All of the American boys of that age were gone. And so the girls, they would, you know, every so often they would have a dance there at the camp, and the American girls would go and dance with the German prisoners.
I don't know if any Huntington girls went or not.
If I'm not mistaken, I think there were a few marriages later after the war that they kept a relationship up and then later married.
Yeah. Well, that's all right if it was successful.
That's neat because, you know, the Forest Festival, you know, is different now than what it, you know, even from the late 40s on, I guess, you know, in the 30s and early 40s, you know, that it was more like the, not just forestry, it was everything. Like you said, it was the county fair, it was the livestock show, it was kind of everything built into one.
It was, and I know it improved. But I believe it,
They used to even have beauty pageants and stuff like that.
Oh, yeah, had beauty, county beauty queens, and of course all ag classes and everything always had the beauty queens as well as, and, but it was, a lot of it's escaped my mind, I know, and I'm fortunate to remember what I can, and, but I just,
So what year did you graduate high school? You had to go back.
1946.
1946, okay. And how soon after that, before you went into the Army, or Navy, I guess, right?
I drove a truck for a couple of years, and our draft started up again, and I was 1A because I registered in June when I turned 18, and I carried that 1A card till I went into the Navy. And
what did you haul driving trucks? Was it ties?
Lumber.
Mm-hmm. Well, where would you deliver the lumber?
Houston, Dallas, Corpus Christi, and any lumber yard. We had a planer mill right up here where the funeral home is now.
Who owned that?
Jenkins Lumber Company out of Dallas. And we had a lot of small sawmills around then, you know.
And they'd bring the lumber here to be planed.
Buy tracts of timber, move their mill there, cut it, bring it into here, they'd air dry it, and they tried dry kilns.
So like portable sawmills, huh?
Yeah. Well, I mean, they could move them in a week's time, you know. Usually had the big diesel engines, you know, that powered them, you know. And that was what most of them...
Do you remember, did any of the Lowrys...
They came along after I went in the Navy. The Lowrys got into the... They started out Lester and Grady. Lester and Grady and they were... And Kirby. They were the older Lowry boys. And then Herbert came along and Giles came along. And then Buddy came along behind them. They all did sawmill work of some kind. Yeah. Of course, Buddy and Lester ended up... They were the last ones of the Lyre boys that had the big chipper mill and all at Woodville. They had the big chipper mill down there when they...
So you worked for Jenkins?
But yeah, Jenkins was out of Dallas he was a businessman in Dallas and he put this, got the idea. So this old, all this land bounded by 69 and 1475, up to the top of the hills, I guess it's about 20 to 30 acres was called Welch Place. And they leased that from the Collinses. The Collinses owned it. J.J. and B.L., the two lawyers there in Lufkin, it was in their family estate. So they leased that and put that planer mill in. And it was just stacks and stacks of dried lumber. They'd buy any lumber off any mill that brought it in, you know. Buy it, pay them for the rough lumber, had people working, stacking it.
Pine and hardwood? Or?
Yeah, they did have hardwood, and they sold a lot of hardwood to, I hauled a good bit of hardwood to Crockett over there I don't know whether they had a pallet factory or a box factory, but they bought a lot of hardwood lumber.
Okay.
But
all of the stuff you hauled was planed. It had all been planed.
We hauled rough hardwood. I never did haul any. And I used to haul hardwood to Alexander Schrader in Houston, lumber company. They bought a good bit of hardwood. And, we all plain lumber, ready-to-build homes, you know. That Jenkins bunch built a big subdivision off of Zangs Boulevard in Dallas, several hundred homes. And we hauled all the lumber for that. The two befores and the siding and everything else.
Yeah. What kind of truck did you drive?
Usually it's a 2-ton Chevrolet or 2-ton Ford. That's about as big a truck as they had then.
How long would the trailers be? Was it just
anywhere,
a truck?
Anywhere from 28 to 32 feet.
32 is long. Okay.
And that was about what?
Single axle truck?
Yeah, single axle. We didn't have the dual isnol tractors like you have. We had a single axle tractor and then had the double axles on the trailers, you know.
Was it gasoline?
Gasoline truck. I think when I went in the Navy, everyone that was hauling away from here, they had some sleeper trucks and internationals, international
put out a big truck with a sleeper on it, and the White Motor Company put out a, and they had the Rio. It came, it became popular. And, they were all gasoline
trucks. REO?
REO.
Like the REO Speedwagon?
Yeah, yeah. And they had a, right up as you go in on Denman, just stay on Denman, go across south first, that what we call four corners, five corners, whatever, and they had a Rio in there by where the Lufkin Glass, Angelina Glass is now.
Hmm.
That was the first
okay.
dealer, this first dealership on the Rio as I saw. And the Whites, I don't think they had a White dealership, but Chevrolet and Ford were popular, and they were...
What speed transmissions?
Well, you could get a, you could get the five-speed transmission, you know, but you could, it, but if they could put a, they called it a stick in it, it was a two-speed rear end, or you could get a brown light transmission, or a, that was the name of the one that would gear it down even further. It had a shifted to it. It had, really had an overdrive and had a low and a, low and a high and an overdrive in it. That's supposed to help your gas mileage, you know. Once you got your standard transmission into what you call the high gear, you could go through your other transmissions. But you, and, so that was, you could, 10,000 feet, 10,000 feet, 10 to 11 was a real good load for the 2 tons.
10,000 board feet?
Board
yeah,
feet alone.
Board feet alone.
It was good. And then when you, the Whites had a bigger motor in it. I think the International had a bigger motor in it. I don't know what size those motors were. And I'm not sure that that International, it, first diesel I heard of was a Cummins, you know, and that, but I we didn't have any, I never drove a diesel then. I got a diesel 7.3 right now, the old Ford Power Stroke. And, but, if I'd have had that, if I'd have had this motor that I got in this diesel out here and the right transmission in it, no telling, in the rear end in it, no telling what I could have pulled, you know.
So did you work for yourself or were you a Jenkins employee?
I drove for someone else.
Okay.
Two men had bought, they had trucks and then they bought a truck in partnership and I drove it a lot of time. But I drove for...
So like when you go to Houston, like, when would you leave? When would you come back? Just, you know, how long would it take and that kind of thing?
Well, most of the truckers in that day wouldn't register their trucks to haul the full load limit. So they had to try to dodge the weight men. You had weight men on the highway, you know, like you got then. So the weight men usually quit weighing about 11 o'clock. If they'd gone to War Dallas, they usually weighed you around Jacksonville. And they'd pull up their scales and go home. But I don't think they worked a solid shift. And it was about the same way at you. If you didn't get weighed around Divo, you might get weighed at Livingston or something like that. So we would leave to go to Houston about 1 o'clock at 2 o'clock in the morning, 1 to 2.
Really?
Yeah, if you left any early, you know, you just had to drink coffee somewhere, dodge into weight men. And Dallas was, we'd leave a little earlier going to Dallas because it took us an hour or so to get to Jacksonville.
So you leave at midnight, huh?
Yeah, and going. Now Corpus, you had to leave earlier, and if you went to Zapata, the lumber yard in Zapata down, you know, on the border, went there, made a couple of trips down there,
Now, did you have to load and unload too, or did you just drive?
Very seldom did you ever have to help any at all. Most time the lumber yards had their own crew to unload, and some would get you out there in a hurry. And we hauled a lot of lumber to Fort Hood. They built up there, but they had a lot of caves in a mountain up there. Well, we hauled up a pretty good hill out there, and it was tough for those 2-ton trucks to get the load because you went up a certain way, and then you had a plateau, and then you started up again, and it was nice to have a 2-speed transmission and to help you get over the hills.
You had to have some momentum to get
yeah,
up that hill.
You did. Because they inspected you because it was Army, they inspected you when you went in and see,
And sometimes they'd ride with you. Sometimes they'd send a sentry with you, you know, an armed sentry. Yeah. He might get up on the back of the load and ride, you know. But it was pretty, I guess you'd say it was pretty confidential, you know, as to what there was going on.
Yeah.
But they let us, they were building office buildings and everything on top. And so we all did that. And when I got out of the Navy, I had a trucker here in Huntington, and he was hauling from Colorado to Florida. He had two new refrigerator vans and two new GMC trucks. And I'd just been out of the Navy about a week or 10 days or something. And he said, "You just the guy I'm looking for, Ted." And I said, "What?" He said, "Won't you start driving one of them trucks for me?" I said, "I believe my truck driving days are over, you know. I never had any desire. It was fun for you know, a young guy driving a truck, driving your own truck, you know, and you,
on the open road.
Kind of a macho thing. You was your own boss and this and that. But after 4 years in the Navy, well,
What did you do in the Navy?
Radioman.
Radio.
Served on two destroyers. One, about 2 years and 4 months, I was on the Taussig. That's what I went to Korea on. In fact, I was in the Philippines.
How do you spell that?
Taussig. DD-746. I was on it for about 2 years and 4 months, and we went to Philippine Islands when the Korean War started in June of 1950. And we with the 7th Fleet, we were part of the 7th Fleet, just maneuvering. I don't know if they knew something was, you know, usually they know everything that's going on and ahead of time. And so we were in that area. They detached us and a cruiser and two destroyers and an aircraft carrier. We went to, headed towards Sasebo, Japan. We went to Okinawa and fueled and took on more supplies. And I don't know where the other ships went to get supplies, but when we got into Japan, we went into Sasebo, and shortly thereafter, we were either in the Yellow Sea or the Sea of Japan for about 8 or 9 months during the start and evacuation. And as the movements went forward, they pushed them back across the 38th parallel and up toward I can't think what river it is now. And all of a sudden, Chinese got involved in it too, because they knew that the North Koreans was being pushed back toward China, and they became involved, and MacArthur wanted to stay with it and just get us back in World War III, I guess, and Truman told him no, and MacArthur must have argued with him, because he said he relieved MacArthur of his command. And,
like some coffee?
Oh, I'm fine, thank you.
Want a drink of water?
Yeah, I might take a drink. Let me stop this. I've been getting some work messages on my phone. Let me check those real quick. All right, we're back. We took a little break, and we were kind of discussing too how to maybe finish up this interview. And like I said, I don't know. We may want to do another one at some point in the future if you'd like. But to finish this one out, maybe just talk a little bit more about general life experiences growing up in your era, in your time period. Do you want to talk about things in life that might have regulated life? You were talking a little bit about the schedule of the trains coming through town.
I'd have to say that my dad was head of the house. my mother was second in command, but she could move into first in command real quick. We were raised with standard discipline, and they weren't afraid to use a belt, mostly a switch for children, you know, that didn't mind. They had problems with obeying orders or told.
And when you say a switch, for the younger groups, this would be a little branch off of a tree limb or something, huh?
And we learned real quick, yes. It could be a switch. The switch was off of a plum tree or a peach tree, because
they would make marks on your legs, all right, but there was no such thing as child abuse. They're just putting the child back in line, you know.
Were you ever given the opportunity of picking your own switch?
Oh yeah, you cut your own switch in the
opportunity for that. Is that part of the punishment?
We had a small orchard, but let me say we never had to prune it because there was enough switches cut off of it. Didn't need to be pruned. A willow switch would wear out real quick. We had a willow tree, and you know, you cut a willow switch, it went away pretty quick. But anyway, and my dad was he had a way of telling you something that I never really forgot. And his index finger on his left hand had a nanny from a snake bite when he was young. It almost made a nanny. It was crooked. The joint was crooked. And when he was telling you something, if you put that joint under your nose and he continued to raise you up to get him eyeball to eyeball, you really understood what Dad was saying.
He raised your head up to look eye to eye.
You had better do what he was telling you. And he didn't use his belt very often, but if it was necessary, he'd use it, and we understood why, because with seven boys and one girl, you know, that's a good many. But of course, his girl was his favorite. She never got a spank. But anyway, my folks were, my dad, they were both Christians. They were members of First Baptist Church of Huntington. He served as a deacon. He served as the treasurer. He served as he was a Sunday school teacher. Mostly he taught teenage boys, seemed like he taught. But we had.
And I want to ask you about church too at some point, but continue on with what you were saying here.
And like I say, we did attend First Baptist Church. We were raised in Huntington First Baptist Church. All of us, all eight of the kids were saved and baptized in Huntington First Baptist Church. And the last boy became a preacher. And he preached for over 50 years.
And who's that?
Richard. My baby brother, born. I was almost 16 years old when Richard was born. And Jerry, my younger brother, was 13. So I used to have a standing joke. I said, Jay, you know, mother and dad had their children about 2 to 3 years apart. And I said, when they had me, I was so cute and pretty, they can't wait till they had another one. And I said, then they had you, and 13 years before they had another one. He said, Jay said, that was an accident. But anyway, yeah, they were older, so I was almost 16. Richard passed away about 3 years ago. He's born in 44, and I believe he's in his early 70s when he passed away. So there's just two of us boys left, two out of the eight children left. And my brother Jerry lives in Fairfield. He's 88. He'll be 89 this year, and I'll be 92. I'm 3 years older than Jerry, but 3 years and a month or two, I think. But we were raised in a church here, and we attended Sunday school and church and BYPU and Wednesday night. And
I say what BYPU?
Baptist Young People's Union. That's where it started out. And I believe the Baptists may have gotten help from the Methodist Church. The Baptist Church was formed, Huntington was formed in 1900, incorporated in 1900. First Baptist Church, 1901. Methodist Church in 1902. I grew up.
So always had separate congregations. Did they ever share a church building? Or?
Well, yeah, they did. You had bivocational pastors or pastors that might preach two Sundays at Huntington and two Sundays, we had a pastor for a long time taught two Sundays at Huntington and then two Sundays over preached at Forest, you know, where Forest is, outside of Wells.
Yeah, and, yeah, Cherokee County.
Yeah, they had he preached over there, but he lived here in Huntington. And, of course, churches couldn't afford the food. Methodist Church minister lived in the parsonage right behind the church, and they were full-time. And we had the Church of Christ, and they were without a pastor a lot. Brother Moody from Lufkin used to come down and preach for them. They'd have Sunday school, but didn't have a preaching service, but he'd come preach on Sunday afternoon. My dad was a student of learning, and he could go listen to anyone, and he was strong Baptist, strong Southern Baptist, strong Democrat, you know, and everybody was strong Democrat. We thought a Republican was a foreigner. Now I'm a Republican, you know, but it's all in a matter of you making up your mind what you like about what.
Y'all still thought of them as carpetbaggers, probably, huh?
We were faithful in church, and all of us were, like I say, saved and baptized in one of the, either in Will Roy's Pond or the McEwen Gin Pond. We didn't have a baptistry at church, and so that's the way we grew up in life, and every one of us had a chance that, well, we were just brought up, we were encouraged to accept Christ. We were never told, we accepted Christ when we felt like we knew what we were talking about. When we reached the age of accountability, we knew right from wrong. You were lying or cheating, you knew it was wrong. Jesus didn't approve of it, you know, so we had a lot of study courses and such as that. We were taught.
You had Bible schools during summer?
Had the study courses, but we had revivals we had outside pastors and song leaders come in, and they would hold a 2-week revival. They'd stay with different people here in Huntington and eat every day with different people.
At the church building, or would y'all do tent revivals?
Well, first tent revival I ever went to in my life was First Baptist Church of Pasadena, and we had about 2,500 in Sunday school, but we had a tent revival. You know, it wanted to have it out on the church grounds, you know, and show people what it used to be like, you know, or have it over in the city park in Pasadena, in the city park.
That's when you worked for Shell Oil.
Yeah, right? or have it at the football field. They had crusades, you know.
Yeah.
All churches went together, and all Baptist churches in Pasadena and would go together and put it on. But, that's our introduction to living for Christ, and so every one of us has helped on to that throughout our lives, and that's been, I talked to a granddaughter last night for a lengthy time about putting Christ first in your life, and it just gives you strength that you don't realize. And of course, I understand from my younger life what younger people, their feelings. My understanding as an older person is what I've jotted down this morning about perception and how easy it is for me to see you and you say 10 words and me make up my mind. I perceive of something, either negative or positive. But you need to give everybody an opportunity, because I might approach you and you might say, well, that's a grouchy old man or something like that. Well, I'm not a grouchy old man, because I enjoy having too much. I enjoy having fun. I enjoy laughing. And I know that it's a whole lot easier to smile than it is to frown. But I just told you some of the things that, you know, life is, as I came up, as I went into that, learned how to pick cotton, I thought, well, everybody picks cotton. When I went to school, I thought, well, everybody, you know, everybody goes to school. But there were kids that didn't go to school. You know, I knew a guy that just turned 95 years old. He and I were freshmen in high school together. He's 4 years older than me. You get my point. There was kids that didn't have an opportunity. A lot of the kids didn't have an opportunity to go to school. They lived in remote areas. There wasn't any funds. There wasn't this. You had to stay home and work to help somebody. So we had a good opportunity, because we were raised by a former school teacher that knew the importance of education that he didn't get. No. And he'd like seen every one of us go to college. Three boys went. The girl married right out of high school, but we were all intelligent. we had the high school education. We could learn anything we wanted.
Did your mother and father live long enough to see their youngest boy become a preacher?
Oh, yeah.
My dad didn't.
He was in his freshman year at Howard Payne when my dad died.
Okay.
He never got to see him. But my mother, like 41 days, making it to 105.
Mm.
So she died in 2009.
Tell about the schedule of the trains you were saying earlier about, it just kind of everybody knew in town, you know, when you heard the train coming through at night. It was 11 o'clock?
That one was, and they had a schedule. One went back through. I don't know where it went to Beaumont and turned around. See, that TNO didn't go into Lufkin. It went to Nacogdoches.
Right.
It didn't. It had a spur going in.
It was Port Arthur to Dallas. Yeah.
World War II was, it was, I mean, they were through all the time. Buses and, of course, gas ration. People couldn't get the gas to go to anywhere they wanted to, so they were on those trains, you know, and they had the passenger cars, or they had the troop cars, or they had, I think I remember them with prison cars going, taking them from Dallas to somewhere else, or to Port Arthur into Beaumont area. But, the schedule picked up there, just like the bus schedule was almost double during World War II. Mr. McMullen from Huntington owned Lufkin Beaumont Motor Coaches, and his son, Morris McMullen, owned Max Motor Coaches that went from Bryan to Jasper. So father and son had two bus lines, and Greyhound and them, they didn't come through here. I think finally American may have started coming through. Trailways, that's what was it. They started coming, but they did stop in Huntington. But we had the bus station here in Huntington for the Lufkin Beaumont Motor Coaches and the Max Motor Coaches. And they had the old bus station there in Lufkin that everybody used, going to Houston or wherever.
You were saying that the train whistle at a certain time was the signal to be
mile sign. At the mile sign, they started whistling on each end of town. At a crossing up here, 1 mile, Huntington, Cross.
Yeah.
X. 1 mile, Huntington. And they'd get on the whistle and start then.
Because
we didn't have a stop law. And
those were just through trains, right? I mean, they didn't stop.
And they had the railroad fenced their property in too, till you got into the edge of a town and everything. And this city park that we have, Centennial Park down here, that's, of course, TxDOT owns it now, but that was railroad property.
Right.
Yep, that was their right of way, and they fenced it. They fenced it down. This is 2nd Street out here. Back up one. There was only one crossing across the railroad track, and that was Main Street. They wouldn't allow any other crossings. These crossings probably happened in I want to say probably no sooner than 1950 for 2nd Street and 6th Street that's on the east side of town. And so that's, but they came, they were on the whistles all the way. So you knew the train was coming through. If you lived on that end of town, and when they went out, they were down on them whistles, you know, because they wanted any vehicle or anything else, you know, away from Maine. And we did have a lady, I was in high school, a lady committed suicide. One night, then it laid her head on the track and come out. She hid. The whole family was looking for her, and the train crew looked for her, and everything else. And when the train left out, she was laying there on the track.
Mm.
But the only thing they could figure is she hid in. They stacked those ties. And so that was upset the whole town.
Yeah, and you remember her name?
Mm-hmm. I don't know if she still got family living. I can't remember her first name, but she was a Renfro. And her brother was C.D. Renfro and Bryce Renfro. And several. It was a big family. She lived with her mother there on Main Street.
Was that the Renfro's, a Renfro Ranch up here? Yeah.
Renfro Prairie?
Towards the Zavala.
Yeah. And Renfro,
I don't know how much kin they were to, like, David Renfro down below Zavala then. His daddy was Preston.
Okay.
And he had a brother, but Preston was raised out here to, Mr. John Renfro was his daddy.
Okay.
And Mr. John was also involved with these Renfros back in here, you know. But he wasn't, he was the father of about three boys, I think. And Mr. John was, he was a state rep at one time. And, but that's just some of my memories. And I worked for different ones, you know. There were several of us boys, and we did odd jobs. We did from mowing to I cut hay with a sickle mower, of course. And I hauled it in, raked it. I got a hay rake out here that I raked with when I was a boy. So a fella gave it to me several years back.
Was that all square bales?
Yeah. No, this thing just. You just raked it up and hauled and put the forked it in a wagon. You hauled it in the book.
Okay.
We didn't have no baler.
No balers.
Yeah. No balers.
Just
I don't remember the first hay baler. They weren't popular. They weren't popular around here in 40 during World War II. It had to be a pretty big farm to have a baler. And they had the sickle mowers, and the only time I saw a combine was my uncle over across the tracks. He planted about 30 or 40 acres of oats. And when it come time to cut it, they cut it with a sickle mower. And it was a fella here had a combine. He rented a combine. They brought it in here and they pulled it with two teams. Either pulled it with four or six horses, pulled that combine. And they shocked that. They raked those up with a rake, and it went along, and it shocked them and tied them into. It picked up those oats, and tied them in and drop them.
Like sheaves.
Just like that. Heads is up just like
vertical,
that.
Vertical. Yeah.
And I remember that, and that was. I'm gonna say that is about 40. Or 41, I saw that. I saw a combine brought into here. Don't know how it got brought in here, but a truck, I guess. Because a man that had owned it, his son had a truck, big trailer truck.
Now, your wife gave me a picture a while ago while we were talking, and it's a picture of Sam Trinkle and William Morgan. Taken in the early 20s, Mr. Trinkle bought a, is that a blacksmith shop?
Blacksmith shop. That's a blacksmith shop.
So what?
Mr. Morgan started it. Mr. Trinkle bought it off of it.
Okay. Who were they? Were the Trinkles, were they the ones that were pretty musical? Did they play a lot of music, guitars and fiddles? And
I'm not sure, but Mr. Sam Trinkle lived on, when you go out 2109 towards the valley, he lived on top of the hill. Where it says Huntington Cemetery, that was his home there where he raised his family. He was a blacksmith, and the Morgans, I believe, further on down on 2109 that started the blacksmith. I graduated with one of the Trinkle girls graduating high school. And, so that's right there where our sanctuary is for the Huntington First Baptist Church now.
Mm.
Right on the corner of, Main and Lynn. Our sanctuary extends out to where the blacksmith shop was.
Just about, that's probably early 1900s, huh?
Well, Mr. Trinkle still, that's, he had sort of the same looking, said Mr. Trinkle bought the shop and ran it until it closed in the early or mid 30s.
But that's like 1910 or
earlier.
That's like 10
Mr. Sam earlier. Was a young man. Mr. Sam was an old man when he closed the blacksmith shop. And he probably closed it in the 40s. Right around there.
But this would be after Huntington started, though, mm-hmm. right? Yeah. So probably between 1910 or so.
Yeah.
The picture's got a bunch of buggies and wagons in it. And you can see several houses in the background. Looks like one's painted. One of them's a white painted house back there.
Yeah. I don't know who that might be. But I can, the businesses I can remember, were Tucker's Variety Store, Gordon's Cab Domino Hall, Fred Thompson's Grocery. I tell you what I'm doing.
Now the Domino Hall, say that name again.
Domino Hall.
But what was the name? I didn't catch.
Gordon Scaff. Scaff Domino. He ran one for a long time.
Now, were any of your family big domino players, 42 players?
Brother, that was one thing we were told to stay out of was the Domino Hall. And he meant it. He didn't play dominoes. He knew there was gambling went on in the Domino Hall. See, you don't have nothing to gamble with. And he did. My mother liked to play dominoes. We'd play dominoes at that. But you didn't go to the Domino Hall.
Yeah, 42 or straight dominoes?
Just straight dominoes. Straight dominoes. Just what we were taught. And he didn't care anything about playing them. And we played some canasta, or we played Chinese checkers, or we played regular checkers. That was our house games, you know. And
did anybody play chess? Was that?
And I played chess. Didn't know anything about playing chess. And we get a sack of marbles, and we played marbles. And when we were out of sight, we played keeps. Any marble you knock out of the ring, that was yours. You kept it. It meant you were playing marbles together. And I could take your sack of marbles home with me before we left. But you didn't tell anybody about it. How come you have so many marbles? You know, what are you doing with so many marbles, you know?
So if somebody ran out of marbles, how'd they get back in the game?
Wait, they got another nickel. Go buy another sack.
So you were a pretty good marble shooter, huh?
Yes. I won a few and lost a few.
When I was a kid, we played around with marbles. We didn't know what we were doing, though. I remember me, my sister, and all my friends, we never did quite figure out how to do it. I guess we had seen something, we knew the idea and the concept, but we never really were any good.
Can I give you a quick overview of what Huntington looked like when I was growing up?
Yeah.
That's what I was looking at.
He's got some memoirs here, I guess. He's flipping through. Now, are you the mayor of Huntington?
No. I served on the city council 3 times from 92 to 98 and got off when I was 70. And, I helped a guy. He came to me when we run for mayor. He was a city councilman. And so before it was over, he's a deacon in Highway Baptist Church, and we prayed about it. And I know in my age, I said, well, let's just pray about this. And we did. And so I encouraged him to run for mayor with my full support. And I supported him, and he's still mayor. Well, his first term in that, one of his council people had to resign due to some health issues with her family. So he came to me and he said, well, you got me in this job. Would you come serve out this person's term? I said, yes, I will serve out a year's term. So I was sworn in and did a 9 to 10 month term, finish it out. I was encouraged to run, so I did. I was elected again. I was encouraged to run. I was elected again. So when I was 90, I got off the council again. So I've served about 10 years as a city council, and I got off of that last year. I was encouraged to help with the Huntington Cemetery in 1990. And I did. I took the job, and it was grave assigner, a grave procurer, or whatever, something they called it. I called it the gopher. So I took the gopher's job in 1990, and along the way, they thought so much of me, I was made president of the Cemetery Association, Huntington Cemetery,
And I've got the president's job, but also retained the gopher's job. So we elected a new board this year in 2020, we've elected a new board. And Barbara and I are still members. She was secretary treasurer when I was elected president. And they made her so we've had that, but we've been able to turn that over, and we're still board members. Like I say, I was ordained a deacon at First Baptist Church of Pasadena, and I became a transfer deacon to Huntington First Baptist Church in 1989, and I'm still an active deacon at Huntington First Baptist Church. So I've served on the appraisal review board for three terms, for 6 years, and
that's the county tax.
The county, yeah. County tax appraisal review board, that's where. And I don't really understand. I feel like God will give me an answer when I should go become an inactive deacon. I really feel like that. But when you're, I've told the pastor several times that I was immune, or I didn't feel like I need to be moving any more tables after I turned 80. And then when I was up at 90, we up and moved tables. He said, I thought you weren't going to do this anymore. But anyway, here's something I wanted to say. I can remember a few things that happened before I started school in 1934. Our house burned completely at West Pecan when I was four. We moved to the Caton place on West Lynn for a while, and then to the George Ivy house on Gibson Street, where the old city hall recently moved from. We moved back to Pecan Street between my second and third year in school. Along about this time, I believe that Huntington had five churches: First Baptist Church 1901, First Methodist Church 1903, Highway Baptist Church, Pentecostal Church or Apostolic Church, and the Pilgrim Home Baptist Church, and also the Church of Christ. That would be six, I believe. But all of our school systems were bounded by Main, Spruce, Mulberry, and Fifth when First Baptist occupying the corner of Main, with First Baptist Church occupying the corner of Main and Spruce. That's where the Memorial Library is now. I remember the main businesses were McKeon General Store, formerly Hall and Hayter, located where First Baptist Church is at present. They owned and operated Cotton Gin, where the city park is located now. On the general store that he closed in 19... On the west side of Main Street, where Second Blessing Store sits now, was my Uncle Dan Ivey's general store that he closed in 1928. He and his father-in-law operated this store for over 20 years. Someone asked Uncle Dan, who was born in 1880, how long he had been in Huntington, and his reply was, since it began. As you move south from the library toward the old railroad tracks, this was a vacant right-of-way except for rail tracks, the depot, belonging to TNO, Texas, New Orleans. Many times you would see quite a few cattle cars, feed cars, flat cars, and they always had stacks and stacks of cross ties, hewed out by hand and mill cut, waiting to be loaded for delivery. The platform at the depot was filled with bales of cotton for loading and transport. I believe most of our Huntington mail was brought in from Beaumont or Points East. Your next business, where the Mexican restaurant is located, was Dr. Stewart's Drugstore and his office facing Main. North on Cedar was the Huntington Bank, the U.S. Post Office that was later turned into a printing office for Huntington News. On the south side of Main was Uncle Josh Ivey's building that had been the Bolivar Collins Grocery Feed and Meat Market. Also on the south side of Main was Mr. Charlie Walton's Dry Goods, Bourbon Renfro's Barbershop, and the telephone office with a residence in the rear. Backing up in this block on the north part of Dr. Shear's building was Mr. John Dennis and Jesse Hamilton's Barbershop, then Miss Jenny Dennis's Cafe. You moved from boardwalk to concrete as you came to the Wilson building.
First Dr. Wilson's drugstore and medical office, and in a small cutout, Lloyd Pig Johnson had a barbershop, and next, Mr. Tom Wilson had a large general store with all the farming implements in the rear, also a large feed building. This covers a block of Maine between Cedar and Pecan, but I left out one of my favorite spots, and that was Uncle John Arnett's Gristmill, located on Cedar, about where Willie Rick's shop is. You could always go by Uncle John's and get a pocket full of raw peanuts, free. Between Pecan and Walnut Streets on Main, the first building that belonged to Dr. R.B. Forrest and housed the post office in the early 30s, upstairs was a lodge, and I think it was Woodman of the World that lodged there. My Uncle Colin and St. Lucille Hudeberg had a cafe in the front of the next building and printed a newspaper in the rear. Mr. Fred Thompson had a grocery store in a building in this group of buildings. Otha Jones later went back into the grocery bid this year. Gordon Scaff had a domino parlor in the next building, and the next building to him was Tucker's Variety. In the late 39 or 40, Dr. Wilson built a brick building on the north and west corner of Main for a drugstore and office building and leased space to the post office. They moved the post office from Dr. Forrest's building to Dr. Wilson's building. On the east side of Main between Pecan and Walnut, where the florist is now, was a two-story building which housed several different businesses, and the Masonic Lodge was upstairs. It had been a general store, furniture store, and maybe something else. Next, it was Hugh Johnson's dry cleaner. Then Mr. Wallace Brown had a small grocery here, and later Mr. J.J. Lasasser had a store and lived in the rear. At one time, the next building was a McMullen, Hawkins, and Chester Davis garage, service station, Texaco chief, but was later all removed, and the bus station and cafe was built on this side. Across Walnut on the north side of Main is the oldest commercial building standing in Huntington. It's not there anymore. As I said, my mother and dad married in 1920. She remembers it being built, but not the year. You would have to say early 20s, and I will show you something in my pictures to prove it. Dale Russell can give you some more information also. Behind this large building, which was built as an automobile dealership, later Brookshire Brothers, number 15, until the late 1840s, S.W. Brown Sinclair Service Station, and a garage repair run by Lofton Thomas when I was a boy, changed hands a lot of times. The Hewitt Hotel on Walnut was immediately behind the old building. Also, there was another hotel on the east side of Main between Pecan and Walnut in the 20s and 30s. The First Methodist Church was directly across the street from this old building and is now the Church of Living Water. I made an error in naming my list of churches at the beginning. The Church of Christ and the Huntington Library Courthouse were on North Magnolia facing Centennial Park. I was told by one of the older settlers that everything in Huntington was built facing the railroad track when Huntington first was organized, all faced the railroad track. Also, a calaboose from the old days was in this area, and later a new one was constructed. Didn't set well with some folks. The Harville Gym was located just past the Hewitt Hotel on Walnut, which is now where Dean's Meat Service is located. And I think I mentioned McEwen Gym. Moving out toward the highway past the old building was a horse and mule barn owned and operated by Mr. and Miss Jiggs Stroop and their son. The horse and mule barn was a big thing in those days because farmers traded with them. That's where the farmer got his, instead of going after a car, he went after a horse and mule. And then Uncle Fulton Cochran had a horse and mule barn plus feedlot behind the implement store belonging to Mr. Wilson on Pecan Street. A lot of businesses and horse and mule trading took place when Uncle Fulton would bring in a new load from Elk City, Oklahoma. I never knew where Mr. Stroop got his horses, but it was big business. Your next commercial building on the west side of Main before Highway 69 was a Cotton Belt Depot, which sat about where Gary G's Auto Parts was. Across the street was a Wilson Gin. Mr. Grover Henry had a sawmill next to the gin for a while. A tomato shed and cannery was next to the railroad for a while. Finley's Gas Station, where Little Boots is now, the railroad tracks ran where Morris Hubbard and Morris McMullen's houses are right through where Brookshire's is now. In 1948, the railroad was taken up, and the depot turned into living quarters. A new Magnolia service station and a cafe were built where the old station is now and Dr. Penn's office is.
I believe Mr. C.S. McMullen bought most of the leftover railroad property, as I know he let us use a portion to build the first Huntington Roping Club in 1946 and 47 along where Morris Hubbard's home is. The Cotton Belt Railroad left several family employees' cars on a siding track after the trains rolled no more in 1939. Across the highway where the jock stop was a hotel that was run by several different folks. When I was young, Mr. Hubert Goode ran it because he had a son my age. Mr. Carroll's Red and White Grocery and Feed Store was on the southeast corner of Main and 69 where the old feed store that had been removed was. Tap Holland had a blacksmith shop next to Carroll's store that evolved into a hardware store. They also sold ice cream. J.Y. Foster had a good store going out of Huntington in the curve of 69 before the Huntington State Bank. The above groundwater tank was riveted up in the late 1930s, and the underground storage tank was about 1940-41. Most of what I have described is prior to World War II, 1940-41. There are many changes made beginning in 1945 after the war ended. You that are younger than Tom, Dale, and myself, who remember how things were during the Depression years. Dale can remember when it started. Tom and I was born after it started and grew up in it. We realized that not much money passed in until the war ended. Those who were not called into service went to the shipyards or refineries on the coast. They began to make money they had only heard of. After the war, many veterans who came home left to find jobs to raise their families with. Most civilians who had left stayed in the better jobs they had acquired. A good many of our folks worked in the Lufkin area, and a few that were businessmen, hard workers, did well in Old Huntington. I left when I was 20, came back when I was 60, and have been back 21 happy years, now 31 happy years. I did forget one place of business that I always remember in Huntington. The Green Lantern. The Green Lantern, located on the opposite side of 69 from the old tobacco store shop, kind of a little speakeasy for after hours, maybe with bootleg whiskey and beer. It was a pretty little rock building owned and operated by a Miss Renfro. Had a speaker out front for the Nickelodeon to carry its sound far and wide. Nothing like going to sleep on a hot August, September night in Huntington with three cotton gins running and the music from the Green Lantern playing Bob Wills and the steel guitar rack. I mean, it's over here with the windows up and everything, that speaker was out on the front of that dude, just about the time you doze off.
Yeah, we probably need to get a copy of that. It'll be easier to transcribe than trying to listen to, but at some point we could get a copy of that. That'd be good. But I always forget to take people's pictures, so I want to do that. I want to make sure I do that. And I was thinking about it just a while ago, but I noticed you got a little deer embroidered on your shirt, and that was one of the questions I had. I wanted to ask you about hunting and fishing growing up. Let me get your picture real quick while I'm thinking about it. And let's see here, on three. One, two, and three. All right, that turned out good. Yeah, just tell me real quick about hunting and fishing growing up.
Well, my dad was a hunter. He loved to hunt. And the old place down here, his part of the 320 acres, can I just back up? His dad, William Joshua Ivey, purchased 50 acres from his dad. We have a deed to that. He paid him for 50 acres. One of his brothers had acquired 110 acres. So my grandfather, Josh, bought, they called him Uncle Tobe. Jamerson was his name. Jamerson Ivy, J.W. I think it was. Jamerson Wiggins. But everybody said Uncle Tobe. Uncle Tobe died plowing.
So that's one of those nicknames, huh?
Yeah. Well, they didn't mind Tobe. I don't know where they got the Tobe. Anyway, my grandfather bought 110 acres.
So he had bought 50 acres from Sires on this side of Parma Ivy, and he bought 110 off of Tobe. And that 110 is in that 120 acres. I'm not sure about all of the 50. I don't know. But that, so he, when my grandfather died, he had 160 acres. And it turned out, well, my dad ended up with about a, thirty-something acres. So he was a baby, the Ivy family. My grandmother married again, had two more children. But he, when my grandpa died, he had four children. My dad was a baby. He got the home place. That's what he lived on through his first marriage with his first two children. And then he moved from the old place into Huntington when he married my mother, moved over here on a, and he taught one more year at Odell. But, so, that was really pretty much still in it. And as we grew up, of course, you could head up the railroad track and go across to the Blunt land, and in there, it was open woods to anybody. Nobody posted anything back then. You didn't see anything. You see no postage there. Unless it was a company or something. But on my dad's off days, if he had a day off and we didn't have things to do, we went to the old place, and we went straight down from his old home place to Stanley Creek, and we hunted. We squirrel hunted both sides of Stanley Creek. So that's
your hunt with shotguns or 22s?
We had shot. My dad had a pump shotgun, and he had a single barrel, and we had a 22 that we didn't have guns for everybody, and of course you didn't need. But Jerry and I, it would be Dad. And Press used to have a single barrel shotgun. Ed would have the single shot 22 rifle. And Jerry and I went, but that's the way we went hunting. But that's the way he introduced.
Y'all just take turns shooting, huh?
That's right, yeah. And you know who would make the decision?
The oldest one.
Dad.
Oh, Dad. Your dad did.
Yeah. But anyway, and sometimes we had a dog, sometimes we didn't have a dog. And, of course, we didn't understand still hunting like he
did. Yeah, that's what I'm going to get to with deer hunting.
Yeah. Y'all. Well, you know, if we still hunted for squirrels, it was all easing through and looking and watching and stopping and waiting. Well, you know, kids are nervous about waiting, stopping and waiting. But anyway, be still, son. Be still. He'd usually get me and Jerry up for him. But then if we had a dog, we just waited till the dog treed. And we had a couple of good squirrel dogs, you know, that you could depend on. The squirrel up there, you know, so that we'd just go to the tree and look then. But that was, he never owned a boat or anything. And there's a few times we got to go to the river and bank fish. It'd be usually be a family thing.
Before we get to fishing, I just wanted to ask, you mentioned you used the dog to squirrel hunt at times, but did y'all run deer with dogs?
If somebody saw a deer track between here and Orr, 10 miles, they'd get back into town. If they saw where a deer crossed the road, they'd get somewhere with somebody that had a dog, and there might be several of them gathered up with their dogs. That's about the deer had been wiped out. When they built the game preserve at the end of 1844, have you ever gone to the end of 1844? 844, you go down.
Past Manning?
Yeah. Go right on through Manning, where the blacktop ends.
Right.
And from there to the road that goes from Highway 69 into Sarin, other side of the valley, I think it's 5 miles through that game sanctuary, and Angelina Hardwood owned 12 or 13,500 acres in there. And somewhere during the Depression time, they built a Texas Park and Wildlife, or whoever it was, must have helped them. They built a game-proof fence around it. And it was managed by Texas Park and Wildlife. And that's where the majority of your deer came from, coming this way and going toward that river over to Corrigan. But that was a breeding ground because it was managed.
Did they stock deer there?
Yes, okay. They brought deer. They brought deer in. And then Dyball Pasture started doing the same thing.
Talking about Barney Sweeney.
Yeah, they did. So that's where,
So you didn't really get to deer hunt much because there wasn't any deer.
I got to deer hunt when I started my latter part of my high school. I went with some of the older men, and we even went to Jasper County, and didn't even jump a deer. Hunt down here, you might not jump a deer. Take your dog. And the odd part about it right now, I can go up here to my pasture, feed my horse, and Bob showed Barbara, we stood there and looked at 9 or 10 deer in my pasture right here in town.
Right here in town.
And, you know, but it was a time when they were scarce. I mean, now my dad and then, they killed some deer when he was young, but they were running with dogs or they still hunted and just waited. But that's in, we're talking about the late 18, or maybe right in 1900, see, because he was born in 91. He would only been 9 years old, but his older brother and his dad and them deer hunted when they came here in 1860. Yeah, they deer hunted, and it was different. There was a lot more animals. And Dad said when he used to get out of school at Oak Flat, that's where they'd come home. They'd come home, and I think they went to school there where Cyrus, where Ivy was, too. They had a schoolhouse there. I don't know who taught it or what. But he said he just picked which way he wanted to go and go kill squirrels in the afternoon. After, you know, as he was growing up. So that was our hunting, and several of us boys took it up, and most all of us liked to enjoy. We enjoyed hunting and going. And even the older brother was in the Army. He was his biggest. He stationed around Cap Walters at Mineral Wells. He used to hunt the pine orchards up there all the time. He killed all the squirrels he wanted to because they wanted them killed out. And
so what about fishing? You said sometimes y'all go to the river.
Well, we just pole fish or have a throw line. You know, we didn't have any trout line, no boat or anything to get it. We didn't have it. I didn't own a boat till I retired. I fished a lot, fished in the bay, fished off of the jetties, fished down at Corpus off of the piers and stuff like that, but I didn't buy a boat till I retired, and I fished Rayburn for a good long while, and finally I didn't. My uncle died, and my brother-in-law died, and they were my fishing partner, and I went with Boots. I fished a whole lot with Boots. He had a camp over on the lake, and so I had my chariot trout landing, had my chariot white perch fishing or catfishing, pole fishing, and but we enjoyed it. Barb and I went out of time too in my boat, and she enjoyed it, but she wasn't going to go with you every day to go fishing. She'd rather do needlepoint or something like that. But a lot of our fun, when I retired, of course you can talk about that later, when I retired, we had 3 grandchildren that I'd gone to the courts to be guardian of, and see them, take care of them, raise them. And so when we came back here, we brought the grandchildren with us, and that's really one reason the size of our home. We were going to build a 3-bedroom home with a large family room, but when we got the grandchildren, we got 3 bedrooms in the back and one up here. We had another. We took our house plans and just added it and made a larger dining room and decided we had in Pasadena we had a living room and we had a family room. We didn't use a living room, so that's the reason we built a bigger room in here. Just that's living family. It's been slept in, slept on, everything is. Because we have a large family.
Yeah.
I've been really blessed. I know I have, and I had angioplasty in 1990, not too long after we got this house built. And they didn't even put in stents or anything, and I've taken some medicine since then, so here I am 32 years later and didn't have any surgery and nothing like that. But when I was 50,
And you're 92, is that right?
I'll be 92 in June. And when I was 50, I was running 4 miles every day. Lost about 30-something pounds and did it for a long time. And then after I retired, I continued to walk. And sometimes I jog, you know. But I walked a couple of miles every day. Haven't done it in a few years now. But I still do my own mowing.
And last year I didn't have a garden. I've been thinking about starting back with a few tomatoes and peppers and stuff this year. And, but we really have been blessed. We've got three children. We lost a little girl in 57. So we've got one boy and two girls. And our oldest daughter passed away. That was her children that we raised. She passed away about 3 years ago, I guess it was. And, four years ago this year. The last year was 4 years ago. But, so we have a, and we have nine grandchildren. I think we got about 15 great-grandchildren, and we have one great-great-granddaughter.
Wow.
So we got a pretty full family.
Yeah. Well, you've had a full life and indeed have been blessed, huh?
I really have. I know, I look back on my life and I don't ever say, oh, I can't do what I used to do. I think, when anybody reaches 90, he can't do what he used to do. But I say my mind still functions pretty good, probably at 90%. My body probably about 80% of what I used to could do. I'm proud of every day that I'm given. And
thank you, Mr. Ivey. I guess we'll just wrap this up if that's okay. And I appreciate your time, and I'll go ahead and turn this off now.